Okay, so we're studying in Matthew 25, beginning in verse 31 and going through to verse 46. And, you know, we've been, this is part of our parables series. And kind of like our first parable class started when we were talking about the rich man and Lazarus, Mitch brought up that this may or may not even be a parable. And similarly, depending on how you define a parable, this could or could not be a parable. Unlike most of the other parables or all of the other parables, this doesn't depict a particular situation that plays out with characters that are used as a parallel. This really seems to be talking about the real judgment. The only thing that makes it very parable-like is the fact that the use of the metaphor of sheep and goats. And so I'm comfortable calling it a parable. My first question originally was, is this a parable? I thought, that's not that interesting to really talk about. But it may or may not be a parable. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Yeah.
I've thought about it as like a prophecy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's prophesying that this is going to happen. The prophets use very metaphorical language, too.
Yeah.
But this is going to happen, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and really, this is very much in the language of the prophets. I mean, you can take a lot of these figures, the figure of the king coming in his glory with his angels and the glorious throne, the picture of separating sheep and goats is in Ezekiel 37, I think verse 14. So all the way through this, you have pictures of things that are actually taken from the Old Testament prophet. So yeah, very much fitting of like an apocalyptic or apocryphal prophecy. And I think it's useful to have some context to this. We're in the last week of Jesus' life here. Back in chapter 21 of Matthew, we had the triumphal entry there at the beginning of chapter 21. That's when Jesus came in, marched into Jerusalem, or rode on the donkey into Jerusalem on that Sunday. People call it Palm Sunday. All the palm leaves were laid out. And then on Monday, we saw him cleansing the temple, you know, whenever there were money changers there, and he whipped, you know, had lashes, and he tried to clear that out and cleanse the temple. And he's just now, as we get to where we're starting, if you go to the beginning of chapter 24, he's just visited the temple for the last time. And the disciples ask this question after he makes a statement about how these stones won't be left upon one another of the temple. He makes this statement in verse 3. Tell us, it's actually a few questions, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming, and of the end of the age? So everything after that, 24 and 25, kind of set up and fulfill these questions. What is going to happen after this? What will be the sign of your coming? What's the end of the age look like? And so he talks about his return, talks about really two different events, the destruction of the temple in AD 70, and then his return. And you have these parables like of the 10 virgins, which is about preparing, being ready for him to come again. The parable of the talents, again about readiness. And then we get to this parable about the judgment. And so with that context, let's go ahead and read this, and then we'll dive into these questions. Let's see. John, could you read 31 to 33?
Okay. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left.
Okay. Dave, could you read verses 34 to 40? There in Matthew 25.
34 to which one?
To 40.
Okay. For I was hungry, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Is that the right one?
Yeah. If you want to go just up one more verse to 34.
Then the king say unto them, on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundations of the world.
And do you want to just keep go on and keep reading down to verse 40?
Naked and ye clothed me, I was sick and ye visited me. I was in prison and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee a hundred and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee the drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, at least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me.
Vera, could you read verse 41 through the end of the chapter?
Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. They will also answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you? Then he will answer to them, saying, truly I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
Okay. Thank you guys for reading that. It's really, I think, one of the most powerful pictures in the New Testament. It's just, this is the end. This is the scene. So let's start by describing this scene. Maybe I'll identify some, just draw out some of the elements as you talk about it. So what do you see? What are some of the elements of this picture in verses, starting in verse 31? What happens?
You have him in glory.
Yeah, the king comes down in his glory. The Son of Man comes in glory. Okay, I'll just draw lines. That's his glory. And where does he go to? Where does he sit?
On his glorious throne.
Okay. So, this will just be a throne. We'll know that. I'll write it so that nobody has to guess. Okay, so here he is on his glorious throne. Okay. And who's with him?
All of his angels.
Yeah. We have all, yeah, all of the angels are with him as he comes. And then who's gathered before him?
All the nations.
All the nations.
All the nations are gathered before him. That's everybody. Everybody is gathered before him, which kind of answers a particular question or a false teaching of that's often taught in premillennialism, that there'll be separate judgments. A lot of people believe that there'll be a judgment when Christ comes a first time or a second time, and then another time whenever he comes back after 1,000 years. Everybody's going to be judged at the same time. We see this over and over again. John 5 talks about a resurrection where the righteous and the unrighteous are raised at the same time. So all the nations are brought before him. You'll be there. I'll be there. Everybody you ever knew will be there. And then what else? What does he start to do?
He starts separating.
Yeah. He creates a separation. Okay. And on one side?
The sheep and the goats.
Yeah. So on his right is the sheep. And on his left are the goats. Okay.
So you didn't draw that to scale?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what was interesting? Well, I'll talk about this when we talk about the sheep and the goats. But yeah, obviously, which group is going to be bigger?
Goats.
The goats.
There's going to be, let's go ahead and try to draw this a little more to scale. So his sheep will be over here. I have no idea what the percentage will be. And the goats will be over here. So there's going to be this divide. And it says he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. So, next question. Why do you think the Lord described these two groups as sheep and goats?
He's the shepherd, the sheep.
Yeah. This is not the only time he uses this metaphor, right? He is the good shepherd. And what does he say about, what are some other things we learn about the Lord as our shepherd, really, in the Old and the New Testament?
The sheep follow his voice.
Yeah, they know his voice. We know his voice if we're his sheep, and we follow him. And other people don't know his voice in the same way. Yeah, what else?
He cares for us.
Yeah, the Lord is my shepherd. The good shepherd protects his sheep. He lays down his life for the sheep. Yeah. What else? When you think of the characteristics of a sheep and the characteristics of a goat, what do you think of?
Well, I was just thinking about, shepherds don't drive, but goats really do need to be driven.
Yeah. It's like cattle. It's more like cowboys than shepherds that need to be.
Yeah, they're a little stubborn. They would never follow a leader.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's an obstinance here where shepherds really do have a relationship. It seems, I'm not a shepherd, but I've heard a lot of sermons about sheep. What I've always read and heard is that sheep really are pretty helpless, and so they become very dependent on a shepherd. And they learn to trust the shepherd, and they go where the shepherd leads them. Doesn't mean really they're any smarter than goats. They're just more reliant on the shepherd, and they trust him and they follow him.
At some level, there was kind of a statement of value there, like that in a lot of the sacrifices that God required under the old law, that the sacrifice was supposed to be a sheep. It was supposed to be a spotless lamb, and those kinds of things. So it was supposed to be that there was one category of animal that was almost valued more and was respected more in the sacrifices.
Yeah, sheep had more value agriculturally. They have more value than a goat. You can do all the things you can do with a goat, but you can get wool. So there's oftentimes, I was going to make this point about the separation whenever you said this, usually a farmer or a shepherd would have a lot more sheep and a lot less goats because the value of sheep was so much greater. And they did separate the sheep and the goats. So if a shepherd owned both, when it came, say, time for night, he would separate the sheep from the goats because they needed to be tended to differently. From what I read, the goats needed to be kept warm, whereas the sheep liked to roam in the open fields. So they would take the sheep out there and put the goats in a place where they could be kept warm. So he says, like the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, he'll go through and say, goat over here, sheep over here, and really distinguish us. And I found it interesting, the word for separated them in the Greek very distinctly makes clear there's a masculine form for the object of who's being separated versus the feminine of nations is more of a feminine word. So what we know from that is that individuals are being separated, not nations. It's not like the Jewish nation and all the Gentiles are being separated, or the Americans and the Germans are being separated. All the nations were gathered, meaning every person, but each individual is going to be separated one by one.
Well, so that was kind of where it goes there is you know, when he talks about the criteria for who gets separated, it's not about, like, your nationality, or it's not about anything other than, you know, how did you treat other people? Like, that was the determining factor. So, kind of to support that, it's not like the Jews were separated off by themselves and the Gentiles were separated off by themselves. This was everybody and every person individually, you know, making an account for what they did.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a powerful picture, you know, of him separating. I did put a divide here just so we could see. And you know, the ratio is about right. Sorry, guys.
Yes!
Actually, these guys are on my right, and you're on my left.
Oh, man.
But...
No! I thought I was there. I was this close.
So, yeah, we have this picture of... Is there anything else noteworthy to you guys about this picture of the judgment that we see there in this first few verses?
He makes a statement of ownership there in verse 33. In verse 32, sorry. As a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats.
Mm.
So he's kind of saying, these are my sheep, I own them, but these other goats, they're just the goats. Like, I don't own these goats, they're not my goats, they're just out there. So it's kind of this wording there that almost seems to indicate, like, these are mine, and then everything else is just kind of incidental. I don't really own these things at all.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's not in the New American Standard that way.
Yeah, New King James, I guess it isn't italicized his, but I'm assuming that's from the possessive part of the word.
Yeah, you would think they wouldn't put that in unless there was a distinction. Yeah.
It says all the angels are there. But that's all it says about the angels.
Yeah.
They don't have part in the judgment of these individual people. So all the angels will be there and be watching, but that's all.
Yeah.
They're going to know from the judgment who the sheep are and who the goats are.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's interesting how often the angels are spectators. They really are there. You get this picture of them watching, and they're rejoicing when we do well. And, you know, 1 Corinthians 11 seems to suggest that there are some things we can do that would, you know, affect them and lead them to falling. It's interesting seeing that picture. The angels are mentioned again, or a certain group of angels are mentioned again in verse 41. What do you see about angels there?
Devil and his angels.
Yeah, the devil and his angels will be in a place of judgment also, but that's not what this judgment is about, this moment of judgment. Yeah. Anything else on question number one about this picture? Okay. So we talked about number two, and I just put this in red because this is not a question we're going to answer here, but a question just that's the context of this whole parable is Jesus wants us to be thinking about, which am I? You know, which words are going to be said to me? Which side am I going to be on, the right or the left? And it's a question that we ongoingly need to be mindful of. Okay, next question. What six actions are given as the reasons for the sheep's entry? So let's go ahead and list these. This is in verse 35 and
36.
Hungry. Thirsty.
Stranger.
Clothed.
What did you do?
Came.
So, what do you notice about these actions? Again, I'm not looking for any particular answer, but is there anything that strikes you about them?
The needs were provided.
What's that?
The needs were provided.
Yeah, definitely. That's, you know, I asked that question next. What prompts each action? Each one, it starts with a need, right? And then you said the needs were provided. So what does that say to you about how this starts to happen? We look for needs, right? What were you going to say?
Well, I just, you know, I've always really struggled with becoming too comfortable with serving those of people who I am closest to. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, inviting people over whom I'm closest to and going over to houses whom I'm closest to. And if I feed the Sheelys, that's great, but they're not hungry.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The idea is that somebody is in a deep need. And so it really kind of gets me out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
Because I've got a lot of friends that don't have a lot of needs.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's also kind of interesting, like, each of these needs, in some way, you could almost take the other side of it and say, well, why are you hungry? Like, why are you thirsty? Why are you, you know...
What'd you do to get in prison?
Yeah, what'd you do to get in? Why are you naked? Like, that's kind of a weird question, I guess. But, I mean, my point in raising that is, like, sometimes we can throw somebody's situation back on them, maybe as, like, an excuse for not helping. It's like, well, you're in that position because of something you did. It kind of maybe goes back to the parable of the Good Samaritan. Like, like how did you end up beaten and left for dead on the side of the road? You know, if you had anything to do with that, I'm not really going to, you know, play a part in your sinful lifestyle or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, in each of these cases, you could almost make the argument, like, somebody might be able to rationalize away actually helping this person. But we
see, I mean, one major lesson of the parable is that when we see the need, that becomes accountability for us.
Yep.
Regardless of their, I mean, their situation doesn't weigh into our accountability.
Right.
It's, we saw that. And we took care of it. Oh, one of the things I was thinking about, I agree with you that this, I noticed a real parallel between all these themes are very clear in, you know, the parables that we've identified to study in this class, you know, from the rich man and Lazarus, the Good Samaritan. There are some themes here. I was thinking about what fills this gap. You know, what, because we all might see a need, we all might see a hungry person, what gets us from seeing a stranger to taking a stranger in? Yeah.
Very caring.
Caring, yeah. Yeah, that's something we saw, see, it's like such a simple idea, but we see that over and over again in Jesus, even in his miracles, he cared. He had compassion on people, and that led him to do miracles, that led him to, you know, take care of people, to look out for people, to teach people, certainly, ultimately, to die for us. You know, accountability, that's the answer I was thinking of, but I wasn't looking for a specific answer, is compassion and caring. The accountability thing kind of strikes me, too. This idea of understanding, because we're accountable, we're responsible for doing something about the needs that we see. You know, that the impetus of judgment, impending judgment, gives us a responsibility then that's beyond just caring. Caring will move us to see those needs more clearly, to look for them, to notice them, and to reach out to people. But also that idea that we will be ultimately judged for our action brings a responsibility. What is there, anything else come to mind to motivate this action?
we're about to see something else, so yeah. I don't want to get into the relationship between us and Jesus, because I think that's another big thing here that he lays out. But
it seems kind of interesting that each one of those things, too, it's like the actions that somebody did aren't confined to like one particular group of people or one particular, you know, anybody could have done any of those things, right? Like anybody could have fed someone else. I mean, provided they had enough food themselves. Like anyone could have given somebody a drink of water or, you know, invited them in to their own hospitality. And so anyone could have provided clothing or visited somebody who was sick or came and visited somebody who's in prison. Maybe that's kind of the, because anybody can do it, maybe that's a little less of the reason why I think I have a responsibility to do it. Because, like, somebody else is going to take care of it, so maybe I don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess that's kind of the responsibility piece of it there. It's like, it's maybe making that connection between, like, well, lots of people could fulfill this responsibility for this person, I am going to do it. Mm-hmm. That's on me to do that.
Yeah, it became my job whenever I saw that need or whenever I could find that need. Yeah. And none of them, you're right, that anybody really, I mean, given that you have ability to feed somebody, it's not a special talent that you have to be a really great food hander-outer, you know? If you can feed somebody, then you can do these jobs. If you can go and get to somewhere to visit someone, you can take care of these things. Any other thoughts on this? Or on these actions? Yeah.
Because of where we live, which is in America, the most prosperous nation, really, for most people. Mm-hmm. Live in America. If you have a job, a home, etc., we have all these things, so we're certainly not in need of any of those things. Mm-hmm. It won't be very often that you will be called upon to do any of those things. But when you are, you need to be ready. That's really the point for us, I think. It can happen. It has happened to us. It can happen no matter your age, however you live, whatever it is, it can happen. You just have to be ready to give when the time comes. It may not be all six of those things, it may be one of those, but still, it's like a test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's going to come at you, and you have to be ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is true that, you know, I feel secure in the high unlikelihood that I'll be naked, you know, not have anything to put on my back. But I think part of what Jesus teaches us about caring, you know, in the Golden Rule and elsewhere, is that I should be able to imagine myself what it would be like if I was in that situation, and be able to, when I see someone in that situation, have that empathy of, you know, what if that were me? And then treat them accordingly.
It's kind of interesting, too, because he's not, like, I've never really connected this, but, you know, he's not actually, these are not all, like, socioeconomical differences, right? Like, you know, every one of us in this room will probably be sick at some point, right? Or everyone in this room will probably at some point be a stranger.
Yeah.
Like, that's not just because I'm, you know, although I am living in a prosperous country, I may never be hungry or thirsty or be naked, but I'll definitely be a stranger sometime, and I'll definitely be sick at some point. And who knows, maybe I'll be in prison at some point for, you know, hopefully for upstanding reasons, but you know, all of these that kind of fits no matter what your economical status is, I guess, you know. And how do we treat strangers, right? How do we treat people who you know, may not be feeling that well or whatever it is. I mean, it still goes to the question of, like, we all will have an opportunity to do something on this list at some point in our life.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
I just thought of one more thing. It's interesting that they are all actions. And it's not like, I know there's the one privilege or verse in the Bible, you can't just say, be warm and be filled. However, it just struck me that sometimes I feel like there's nothing much I can do because of my situation or whatever, but I can at least pray. And I just realized that that's not on. That's not mentioned as something to do for someone else.
Yeah.
In this instance.
It's a good point. Not that it's not important, but it's, sometimes that could become a crutch where, you know, oh, well, I'll pray for you. I think we talked about this earlier in another lesson, and that becomes, instead of, here, let me find a way to help you.
If I can help, give me a call.
Yeah, yeah.
You just let me know if I can do anything for you.
See ya.
I'm out of here.
You mentioned opportunity.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of, we always have the opportunity because we are in a large congregation and we have a lot of people that are sick every Sunday, every Wednesday. You know, there's numerous people around us that aren't there. Why? Have we all taken the time to give them a call, go by, visit, see what the problem is? There's things that happen, the floods, the fires, you know, are we helping them, taking care of their needs, you know, if they're hungry, are we getting water, are we getting clothes together? I'm just thinking the opportunities are there. We just have to.
And every time we have a service, right, like somebody comes in visiting from somewhere else, we've always got a stranger, somebody who we've never met before, you know, and people can even be strangers even after they have been here for a while. Like, you know, if we don't know them very well, we're not getting very close to them, like, we've got an opportunity right there. Yeah. I feel like I should invite everybody over to my house right now.
But we're not strangers.
But we're not strangers, right?
I mean, we'll still come over.
Yeah, but it's...
And yes.
Yeah, going back to what you were saying, Joan, and this, what you guys were just... I love that what you both were identifying is specific actions, like getting right to, here's something I could do. And that's part of the job of studying. The most important part of the job of looking at these needs is, what specifically can I do? It's like my wife and I have this ongoing conversation about the difference between being and doing, and it's sort of a philosophical conversation, I guess. But I think more in terms, it was really helpful to us to understand this, I think more in terms of being, of attitudes, of the thought process, of the compassion and the caring and the responsibility that leads me to act. And she thinks more in terms of the actions that come from those things. She doesn't really think about this stuff. You just do it. Get the job done. She's a very practical person. I'm more, as Michelle would say, thoughty. My point in bringing that up is both are essential and one creates the other, back and forth. You know, if we're looking to do the action, we're building that compassion in ourselves. We're building that sense of responsibility, and it'll only grow, that compassion, the more we do for people, and vice versa. If we're praying for someone, really praying about them, our hearts will be stirred to act and to take care of them. So, any other comments on this piece of it? Question number three. Okay, question number four. How does this explanation fit with the New Testament teaching of salvation by grace through faith, not by works? I was reading some commentaries, and there were several things that denominational commentators had a lot of trouble with. Like, how this can't possibly be talking about the real judgment and how it will work, that he would make this decision based on what we're doing, because that's not, we know that we're saved by grace, not by anything that we do, which is, that part is absolutely true. But it still, I believe, is talking about the judgment. How do you reconcile the fact that Jesus just gave these six reasons for entering, bringing the sheep in, and for not letting the goats in spite of the fact that we're saved by grace through faith?
Well, I think that illustrates that you can take any parable too far.
Right.
You know, they all have to be taken in context of the entire New Testament. But even if we did all of those things every single time we ever had the opportunity, and yet we sinned, you know, James says you sin one time. You're a transgressor of the entire law.
Mm-hmm.
You're a lawbreaker.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, even if we did that every single time, all of those actions, and yet we sinned, we still need God's grace. But, you know, they are works of faith. You know, it's not, we're not doing these because I have to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sense of responsibility is there, but that sense of responsibility is there because of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always tried to really emphasize that in my mind of, you know, works of faith, faith working, not just strict obedience to some law that you don't care about.
Right. Yeah.
It's the book of James that exactly talks about what he's mentioning right now. Faith without works is dead, being the law. So you have to have the works to back up what you believe, to show what you believe.
Yeah. Yeah, so these things aren't, as Alan was saying, going to earn us our salvation. We don't deserve it. That's what, whenever Paul talks about we're not saved by our works, it's saying we can't earn our way into heaven because of our sin. That negated that possibility. But if we have a living faith, a working faith, a faith that is manifest in our life, that allows us access to this grace. Our faith allows us to be forgiven and allows us to walk with God.
It's kind of the natural conclusion of what Paul was saying in Romans about, you know, should we just continue living in sin so that grace can abound? Like, because grace is such a factor, do we just have the license to live however we want? And knowing that grace is just going to come in and take care of all of those sins. And the conclusion of that was certainly not. You know, how are we supposed to put to death something and then still live in it? How are we supposed to put to death this old man but still have him around when it's convenient and call on grace to kind of cover all of those choices that we've made? And this is kind of a list that personifies like the opposite of living a sinful life. This isn't about you. This isn't about yourself. This is about living for others. This is about humbling yourself and living a meek life of service. And that's, you know, obviously he's not saying that any of these things are going to earn us salvation, but we can't be going off and just living a selfish life for ourselves and thinking that we're going to have this grace that's going to cover it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is this a comprehensive list of the things that we're told precede salvation? No, there's other things we have to do that the Lord says, you know, and faith isn't even mentioned here, you know. Repentance and baptism and worshiping the Lord and all of those things that we're told to do aren't listed here. So it's, like Alan said, not a comprehensive list, but it does tell us that even though these things don't earn our salvation, we're completely at God's mercy, that these things will weigh into our final end. Common kindness is going to be a factor that determines who the sheep are and who the goats are. Okay, any other thoughts on number four? Okay, number five. What strikes you about the response of the righteous? You know, here in verse 37, the righteous will answer him, and they give their response in verses 37 through 39. Anything noteworthy? Yeah.
It's the same response as the unrighteous. Basically, like, when did we see you?
Yeah.
We never did that. Like, we never did that for, you know, for you, and that's kind of what the unrighteous hear as well, like, or that's what they say as well. It's this, You know, when did we have these opportunities to do that?
Yeah, you're right. They're really almost the exact, maybe the exact same question. Yeah.
But what it illustrates, it kind of plays into number four, is they clearly, well, I guess they were confused about, you know, doing it to him.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, you know, they don't have this prideful attitude. Good thing you noticed.
Yeah.
Because we were doing these to get in.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't seem like they're showing up like with an expectation. Like I punched my clock, and now you got to let me in. There does seem to be a humility there. It's funny. As similar as these two are, you can just kind of hear a different tone of voice.
Yeah.
You know, just because the circumstances.
Sweet.
When did I do that to you? That's the unrighteous. When did I do that to you? You know, that's the righteous. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that? On number five. Number six. This is a little bit of a facetious question, but I think there's something, some that is worth talking about. I meant to be thought-provoking, not facetious with it. Will we be judged based on how we treat all people or just Christians?
I think all people. I wasn't here for the parable about the Good Samaritan. I certainly think that's referring to all people, you know, whereas
yeah.
This one may be kind of honing in on what we do for those of God's family, but it's we definitely have a responsibility to walk, you know, as Austin pointed out to class yesterday afternoon, circumspectly, you know, wisely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here we do see in verse 40, he says, "To the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me." So there. It seems like he's talking about brothers in God's spiritual family. You know, Christ is our brother, God is our father, rather than brothers in the human family of God. So if here he's talking about what we do to brothers, it kind of makes sense when you look at the context. I think a verse that kind of parallels what Alan said is Galatians 6:10. You know, that we should do good to all men, but what?
Especially
to those of the household of faith. So if we look at the broader context, compassion is not limited to a certain, you know, compassion for a stranger is not limited. You're going to have compassion for, if you have a compassionate heart, if you see someone in trouble, you're going to care about them. You're going to look out for them. You're going to want to take care of them. But how much more so for those who we share like precious faith with?
I have to wonder what the Jews are feeling like right now. Because like, I know we didn't really talk about it, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, when he references there that all the nations will be gathered there before him, I mean, basically the Jews are kind of getting lumped into that group along with all of the Gentiles. And you have to think that when he's starting out talking about God separating the sheep from the goats, that as he's talking about that, the Jews are probably thinking like, well, I'm a sheep, obviously, since I'm a Jew, and he's separating me out between the goats, which is the Gentiles. So they probably have this like prideful mentality right about then. And when Jesus says that it has nothing to do with your nationality, it's about how you treat each other,
yeah.
That they're probably kind of shocked right now, thinking like, you mean to tell me this has nothing to do with what background I have, you know, my family relationships or, you know, what my nationality is. This is actually how I treat just common folk.
Yeah.
And that's probably really shocking to a lot of the Jews. I don't, whenever I think about the all nations that and them getting lumped into that, this is kind of a picture of like what the church was going to be. And he's foreshadowing here that this
yeah.
is all nations really does mean everyone together.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure they fully understood that yet at this point.
In spite of all the prophecies about it, that talking about all nations, yeah. Yeah, they could actually separate themselves out. You know, Gentile just means nations. You know, so they could have even heard that and separated themselves out of that. Like, oh, this is how he's going to judge the Gentiles until he gets to the. This is what the kingdom was built for.
The reason why I even thought this is in the New King James, the, like, I don't know if you know, but the little titles that are at the top of your paragraphs, they're called pericopes, and it's just like a human wording or human, like, phrase that somebody came up with. But mine says judgment of the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's saying these things to Jews. I think he's including them in this, so I don't think he's just talking about judging the Gentiles here. I think he's saying everyone, whoever you are, is included in this group.
Yeah, definitely. Mine just says the judgment, so that's correct.
Yeah, yours is.
What verse do you have?
The New American Standard, large print edition. Okay, so number 7, what other applications could we make using the metaphor that whatever we do to these, we do to Christ? And how's this idea useful in our lives? You know, we talked about reasons, and I kind of alluded to the fact that thinking about Jesus being in this situation and the fact that whatever we do for these people in this situation, we're doing to him directly. That's how he saw it. Our relationship with Jesus, the special relationship we have with him, might factor into this motivation as well. What other applications could you make? Does this just apply to people who are hungry, thirsty, strangers, naked, sick, and imprisoned, that whatever you did to these people, you did to me? Or could we make a list of another 20 things here?
It's like grieving.
Yeah.
You know, comforting the grieving.
Yeah. Yeah, when you were depressed.
Visiting widows and orphans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Giving somebody the benefit of the doubt or listening to somebody is kind of a skill that takes a little bit of work on our part.
Yeah, yeah. If we gave everyone the benefit of the doubt like they were Jesus, you know, would we give him the benefit of the doubt? If we sat down and listened to, you know, whenever our spouse or some coworker is talking, listen to them like we were listening to the Lord. We just kind of brought that level of regard, respect, and affection to others, especially other Christians, that in any situation, I think that's a really useful, to me, a really useful idea to just treat people like I would want to, you know, in one case he says, treat people like you'd want to be treated yourself. That's one thing. I want to be treated well. But I really want to treat the Lord well. That even motivates me more. Treat people like you would want to treat the Lord. Obviously, there's some boundaries to that. I'm not saying worship other people, but take care of them. Look out for them. Look at their needs and know that Jesus is going to view this in this way. Any thoughts on that?
Even like working, right? I mean, we're told to work as if we're working for the Lord. So, you know, it's not just about like the relationship that you have with your employer. Like, you're kind of doing these things just like you're doing it for God, which is kind of fits along these same lines, I would think.
Okay, number 8. How does Christ describe the people on his left? It's verse 41.
Accursed.
What does that mean? Curses are often talked about in the Bible. Now I'm wanting to look up the original meaning of that word. The accursed ones. And where are they sent?
Fire.
Okay, so the original meaning of that word, verse 41, cursed, to Execrate, by analogy to doom or curse, it comes from a word meaning cursed. Yeah.
So they're doomed.
They're doomed. Doomed ones. The thing that struck me about this, and about just that word, and about the sentence that's given to each one, and it's just the distinction that the Lord, how different God and Jesus responds to people. Two different people, both of whom he created, both of whom he loves, both of whom he wants to be with. And based on, in this parable, these actions, how he treated people, he said to one, come on in and enjoy this perfect place I've prepared for you. And to the other, accursed one, go to eternal fire. There's something about God's straightness and clarity of judgment that's there that's just so powerful. It just has to be factored into our thinking. I don't think if I had two people in front of me, I don't know if I could make that clean of a break, of a judgment between these two. But it's not, there's no in between. There's just one way or another, and it's all based on, based on our lives, based on how we respond to what he has told us to do. So that was powerful to me. Any thoughts on that? Okay. What's the difference between the preparation of the place for the sheep and the goats? Look at the preparation of the place in verse 34 and the preparation of the place in verse 41. Inherit the kingdom
prepared
for you when?
From the foundation.
From the foundation of the world. You're going to a place that's been built for you from the beginning. This was prepared for you. And what about the other side? Into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for who?
The devil and his angels.
You know, that definitely says something about how bad that place is going to be, doesn't it? God created a place for the devil. Yeah.
How, you know, I was thinking about this when you were talking about just the clarity of, you know, it's over. You know, God's given us so many chances in life. But how bad does God have to look at sin for someone to go to the same place as the devil? Mm-hmm. Someone to go to the same place as one of his angels? That's really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just illustrates how ugly sin is. And if we just have a peek into God's mind about how ugly it is, it would be so helpful.
Yeah.
And we do. Little pictures like this.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that, right, is like, how much does he have to love righteousness and truth to have prepared a place for people who would follow him? I mean, that to create specifically a place where people could be with him for the rest of eternity.
That's a good point. Same place as him.
I mean, that's...
And to overcome the sin that he hates, right. You know, to prepare a way to deal with that, knowing that we had that in us. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. One thing that I noticed, it's interesting, you said that they had the same exact response, which I didn't even notice that. The thing that struck me about the goat's response was that they called him Lord too. You know, we talk about Matthew 7 a lot, and but that's right here also.
I was thinking about that when we were talking about the imagery of the king. Nobody second-guesses what's going on here.
Yeah.
Like everybody's understanding. No one's like, whoa, I think I should be a sheep. You know?
Yeah.
When they're not like, who are you again?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I don't believe in you.
Everybody knows who he is. It's just his authority is most definitely accepted in this scene.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's going to bow a knee to him. It's a matter of are you going to do it here, or is your, you know, are your knees going to be broken, and, you know, you brought down to recognize his authority. Yeah, it's striking, that picture. And finally, if you were to boil this passage down to a few words or a single theme, what would it be? And this is something, it'd be nice to get a few different answers on. What did you call that word at the top?
The pericope?
Pericope. I've never heard that before.
Really?
I remember that, yeah. Pericope. What would your pericope be?
Google it, man.
For this passage.
Awesome.
Maybe we could just personalize it and just say, rather than the judgment, my judgment.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Go back to that. Which am I question? You know, I mentioned the idea that, to me, what this boils down to is the idea of how these simple acts of compassion play into the greatest moment in history, the final judgment, you know, and how my destiny is determined to a large degree based on how I respond to those in need. That was more than a few words. If you were to put it into a sentence.
This was a pericope.
Yeah, I know, that was the longest pericope ever.
It's almost like the summing up of importance. Like, Alan made the point in a lesson a long time ago about, like, of all the things that Jesus could have highlighted here, he highlighted these six things. Like,
yeah.
Not that this is the extent of all that will ever be judged on, but, like, of all the things he was going to highlight at this moment, he highlighted six things. And what do these things say about our responsibility? I mean, I think they just say that we have a responsibility to love our neighbor as ourself. And it really, like, while we might kind of gloss over the first and second commandments, you know, love God with all our heart, soul, and mind, love our neighbor as ourself, like, this is that second greatest commandment, right? And built into this is sort of he implies here, it's also the first commandment.
Exactly.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart.
Yeah.
Do these things for other people exactly like you're doing it for the Lord.
Yeah.
And this is basically the first and second commandment. That's why this is so important. You know, we get wrapped around the axle with all the other things we have to deal with and think about and do. But if built into us is a love for God and a love for other people and a care and compassion and a sense of responsibility that we have, I mean, that's going to go a long way in helping us on that last day.
Another pericope I might throw in there is...
It's the word of the day.
Yeah. I didn't know that word either. Is involvement in the church. You know, if this is God's family,
mm-hmm.
you know, how can we explain away a distancing of ourselves? Or, you know, that it's all about us mentality.
Mm-hmm.
When you really, you know, this parable just... highlights, or this prophecy, or whatever it is, really highlights how involved we should be in the Lord's church. I mean, you got to be able to see these things in people's lives, and to see them, you've got to be involved. Otherwise, how could you?
Yeah, yeah.
I was just thinking about that because John has a friend at work that he's talked to and known for many years, and she will not come to church. She's like, God's wanting me not to come to church. And I was thinking about that list. You know, well, how do you know who's hungry then? How do you know of the brethren who are thirsty? How do you know of somebody who needs clothes? How do you know of somebody who's sick? If you don't go, you don't know.
Yeah.
So, you know, and John has tried talking to her more than once. But you just, there's so many people that they feel that way. Well, I don't need to go to church. As long as I'm doing what's right.
I stay
at home. Understand that this is how you do what's right.
Yeah, and it's, I think what underlies all three of those comments in my mind is that we're intended to live in relationship. That the way we live in relationship with one another, it is, you know, what determines how God views us to a large degree. Yeah, that's a great thought. Any other thoughts? All right, thank you.